Welcome back to The Hidden Agenda, a podcast brought to you by Changing Relations. I'm Primrose, a student at Durham University and an intern at Changing Relations, and today I'm joined by Dr. Julie Scanlon. We're going to be talking about leadership and gender roles and how we can become more aware of our own privilege to create more inclusive spaces. Julie, thank you so much for being here today. Would you like to introduce yourself however you would like to be introduced, and tell us a bit about your current work?
Thanks very much, Primrose, and thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm excited to talk to you today. So I am a consultant and a trainer and a coach, and I specialise in my consultancy and training around diversity and inclusion work, particularly to do with gender equality and diversity and inclusion. And I've been doing that for around 3 years, sort of on and off. And previously, I used to be an academic before I kind of set up on my own. So my work involves working with organisations and groups to promote, I suppose, and advocate for diversity and inclusion, and to also support organisations and individuals through coaching to develop themselves.
Great, thank you so much. So in some of your facilitation work, you talk about things like understanding privilege and women in the workplace and challenging unconscious bias. What's the sort of current demographic of sort of leadership and sort of the impacts of privilege and bias that you see sort of currently, like, in your work?
Yeah, I mean, all of the statistics on leadership, they do demonstrate things haven't changed very much from many organizations' leaders being, you know, straight white men in their 50s, basically. And the difficulties around that, or the challenges around that, are, again, all of the research shows us that if we have diverse groups, diverse leaders, it gives a better representation of what your workforce might be like, what your clientele might be like. If you're, thinking about universities, that might be your students. Or if you're thinking about corporate organisations, that might be your customers. So if we have a very small demographic in the leadership roles, then we're not getting that kind of breadth of thinking that is going to be sort of appealing and is going to actually boost business performance as well. And there's a lot of research out there that tells us that diverse leadership teams lead to better performance in that kind of business case sense, as well as obviously it being the social justice and moral and ethical things that we probably want to focus on more, that I kind of want to focus on more. So things like work I do around unconscious bias, around making people, helping people be aware of their privilege, it's all to try and support organisations really to understand how their individuals within organisations and how systems and structures all impact on whether that workplace is accessible to, you know, clients or customers, or whether it's accessible to even just be moving up through the managerial kind of ranks, I suppose, within the organisations as well. So all of the diversity inclusion work I do really is always focuses on the structures of things as well as individual responsibilities. So by structures, I mean things like promotion processes, the kind of culture that a workplace has in terms of what kind of banter, in inverted commas, is being used around the place, what the messages on the walls, what kind of support is in place for people that want to move through and develop in organisations. So it's those structural things as well as the sort of individual responsibilities that I try to focus on.
That's such interesting work. It's, you know, so necessary today. Do you think there's a reason why, I guess, this sort of straight white old male demographic has sort of been seen as a better leader throughout history and culture?
That's a big question, Primrose. But yes, I mean, it goes back, if we listen to Mary Beard, and if people haven't heard Mary Beard talk on this topic, I suggest they go and Google her and listen to something or read something. Mary Beard, an academic, she talks about how our Western culture has come from the Greek and Roman kind of times, where the person in public was the man, and he was expected, as part of his becoming a man, sort of movement from a boy to a man. She talks about how it was expected that he would speak in the public sphere. Women were not expected to speak in the public sphere. In fact, the other way around, they were expected to be quiet. So she tracks it right through from kind of our ancient history in this country that has been influenced, and how these traditions have developed around a sense of who is a public speaker, who is a leader, and this kind of sense of men being in those dominant roles, which our organisations have developed, our sort of organisational structures have developed in those very hierarchical senses, where you do tend to have one leader and have it would be a CEO or a vice chancellor of a university or whatever. And this kind of the way that those very hierarchies are built puts a sense of leadership onto one person. And through those whole, those really ancient traditions that have developed, I mean, that's one route that Mary Beard talks about. It gives us, that's how it's formed. So there's a lot to undo in terms of attitudes towards women in the public sphere and women as speaking out and as being entirely competent at those leadership roles. But there is still the expectation that a male leader is kind of what we expect to see, in a way. We, in inverted commas, again.
That's so interesting. Thank you. I love Mary Beard. She's so iconic.
It's fabulous.
I was listening to another podcast that Mary Beard was on, and I think she was talking about how sort of in these ancient societies there were actually groups of women who did have a lot of power. So I think Amazon warriors were this really powerful group of women who were honored in battle in the same way as men were. But throughout history, those stories have been erased in order to, or sort of less recognized. And some of these documents are even sort of lost completely. You can only pick up fragments. So these powerful women in history are, erased in order to fit this current, to kind of back up the this imbalanced power system that we have.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because we're in that position of needing to do kind of recovery work to learn more about those different systems that we hear less of, that have been, as you say, the kind of history that we get taught. It's there's a particular story, and people do talk about his story as something as opposed to her story, which we learn much less of. It's got a little bit better, obviously, in recent times. But so there's recovery work to do and exploration work to do. And it's how, a lot of feminists in the 70s, sort of academics and in other spheres, were really about this kind of, we need to start looking at recovering. Well, where are the women politicians? Where are the women writers, etc., etc.? So it is interesting that we're still in that process of recovering some of our histories, I think. And I think that it all mixes into this kind of sense of, yes, of course, women have always existed. So what were we doing? We were doing an awful lot, but we often don't hear those stories about what we were doing.
Exactly. And I think the sort of current discourse on equality often confronts women with the challenge to prove themselves, to do as men do but better, to sort of be worthy of having the same privilege. So as such, how women have to adopt leadership practices that exist within this patriarchy that we find ourselves in, which I think in itself means that. So when women model themselves on a masculine power structure that already exists, that leads to less successful leadership, because I think naturally we see men as sort of autocratic leaders and women more as catalysts and democratic leaders. So when women try and behave like male leaders, that's not always seen as successful and sort of used an excuse to say that, oh, men can do it better. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really interesting area, as you rightly identify, the kind of the patriarchal structures where we have that kind of the man at the head of the organisation or whatever. You know, as we've just been talking about, it's been created over time and it's become kind of ossified, and it's like being consolidated in that this is what a leader is, and it's that masculinist. It's the traits that we associate with masculinity, which are social constructs anyway, but it is that sense of what has become favoured in our society and in our sort of organisational structures is that kind of leader that possesses the qualities that we associate with masculinity. So it is, and they get kind of hierarchized and privileged. And as you say, this kind of sense of, you know, women have, and men, of course, because they don't always all fit into that, what that masculine stereotype is, and with, you know, the bold leader and all that. But women in particular, you know, we're in organizations where they haven't been made for us. So you sort of find yourself, I think, what women find themselves often trying to find a way to navigate this system. It's a bit like a maze, which actually the pathway is not straightforward. So as you've suggested there, it's like, do we adopt a style that is feels perhaps quite alien sometimes and is quite alien to the way that we are socialized as girls and women? We're not socialized to speak up. We're socialized to be in the kind of more supportive catalyst roles. It's a nice phrase that you've used. And so what, you know, I think leadership qualities, they can get problematically categorized as sort of masculine and feminine leadership qualities. And what happens there is that the feminine leadership qualities get deprivileged. And so we do have lots of wonderful leaders who, sort of women and men, that might work in a collaborative style that are really, supportive of their people that they're supposed to be leading, that they are leading. And yet that kind of leadership style can be questioned. Although, I mean, I think just to pick some amazing examples that we've had recently, obviously in the wider political world, we have people like Jacinda Ardern, who has been really, everyone wishes that they lived in New Zealand right now because of the way that they've organised themselves around COVID. But, they're a very different country to the UK, for example. But, if we compare, and we've seen all of that come out around those stats with countries that have had women as leaders have seemed to have done a lot better in the COVID pandemic than those that have had male leaders, but particularly obviously us in the US. I'm not even going to say their names.
I understand. Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely think that sort of in order to have a, truly feminist or, truly equal society is that we have to break down the current structures that we have.
Absolutely.
Rennie Edo-Lodge, who wrote Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, she talks about how, yes, the feminist sort of, I guess, agenda is an ideal, but aren't all political views, all the structures that we have now started off as ideals. Mm. And now they seem completely impregnable. But what we have to do is start to realise that this isn't the way that it has to be. Mm. And I think in your work? So if we're talking about leadership and your work is sort of talking with like the leaders of organizations about the demographic of the sort of wider community of an organization, and so when we have a more diverse community, that means that there'll be more diversity in leadership as those people sort of rise up. Mm-hmm. And that's where we can start to make change.
Yeah, that's right. I love that, you know, that idea. Yes, everything started as an ideal, and some of it became concretized through use of power as to what ideal got, you know, and now appears to be the norm. And absolutely, if we do have more diverse members of an organization, employees or whatever we're talking about, what we need to make sure is that those structures are enabled to work for them. So it is really examining the structures to ensure that they're not being, that people are not being disadvantaged because of who they are. And it's a big task because we're never talking about an organization on its own. So Durham University, for example, it can do loads of great things, but it exists in the world. And those people are being disadvantaged. So we might be thinking Black and minoritized ethnic people, we might be thinking LGBTQ people. These sets of people, certain demographics of people, are disadvantaged in all sorts of ways around the country, around the world, and just kind of in different structures. So every individual organization has a responsibility to try and kind of counter the discrimination that they're encountering in other spheres as well, because it's never just what a person doesn't just exist within that single organization. So it's trying, you know, I think organizations, because they have big influence, usually large organizations, they do have quite a responsibility and a role to play, and if everyone did work at it, there would eventually be some change, and it would move us towards that, the more ideal state, if ever we could get there.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm really looking forward to this sort of ideal that we have now becoming a reality. It seems so, yeah, sort of like a dream, but I really have hope for what we can do. I also really agree with what you're saying about Durham University, you know, really having so much influence, and there are really things that, you know, that need to be changed. It's a very, very homogenous space, I think. And I think that's maybe starting to get tackled, but really not enough.
Hmm.
So what do you think that we can do, or as students and staff and sort of higher up the governing board, what can be done to start to make Durham University more inclusive, do you think?
I think that's a big question as well. And I think it starts really with everyone taking a responsibility to get educated and listen to perspectives that, you know, they might not ordinarily listen to. So that's about kind of reading stuff. It's about, you know, listening to podcasts, etc., from voices that you might not ordinarily hear, unless you kind of go out of your way to sort of educate yourself on something. So, for example, just a sense of, reading a newspaper article that you might normally skip over if it's, let's say, you know, you're not that interested in Islam. Well, if there's a newspaper article, you know, have a read of it, see what it's saying. Being cautious about newspaper articles, I suppose, and the agenda that's there. But you know, it's that sense of we're all always learning. And if every individual does that, and I'm guilty of it because I work around, you know, some specific areas in diversity and inclusion, and I have to remind myself to keep, you know, I'll read things around disability, for example, and as I say, around Islam, that will just sort of give me an insight. And I read from thinkers that, just to kind of broaden my perspective. So I think right from the student level up through to the senior leadership level, this is something that everybody can be doing as an action. You know, it can be a little read something every week that you wouldn't, you know, and I'm just talking about a short article, read something each week that you wouldn't perhaps have thought about this reading before. But then, of course, I think as students, you collectively, as a student voice, you can use your systems and your kind of representation systems, whether that's through your colleges or whatever, to, you know, to make your voices heard about any changes that you want to see and anything that you see as problematic or that you think could be improved. And it's going through those kind of semi-formal structures, I suppose, because through those kind of systems and conduits, you can make your voices heard to the leadership team, because if they feel it's important to students, you know, then they will start to listen and start to kind of and start to act. And I think, you know, that just works at all levels. So students and staff can be doing that and kind of just, you know, using any kind of ways to speak with the leadership team and make sure that they know that this work is important to you.
Thank you so much for that. On a sort of individual level, also in like a sort of small group level in terms of the societies or maybe sports teams that we have at uni, I think you maybe touched on it there about sort of going out of your way to read or inquire into things that you wouldn't normally. But how can we start to challenge or sort of become aware of our own privilege?
I think it is a good question. Because we do wander around without much awareness quite often, I think, all of us. And I think it is around, as I said, that kind of educating, listening to people, looking at, you know, who is leading those societies and what is the kind of language that's coming out of those leaders or the team that's leading them or whatever, in terms of, does it feel as though it's inclusive to anybody that would want to join that society or that team? I think it is very much a sense of, you know, there's also a personal responsibility. If there are ways to report anything that people are not comfortable with, that they've witnessed or, you know, have seen, using sort of university rules to report those as well, and trying not to, you know, if you feel safe to do so, that is to report kind of, and it is that sense of trying not to enable a culture if possible, if we see things that are problematic. So I think that, you know, thinking about how the kind of promotion of how societies and sports things kind of promote themselves, is it sort of around the kind of language that they're using and around the kind of imagery and the kind of overall feel of the thing, whether it feels like you know, there's problematic stuff going on there, or whether it feels like they are inclusive to whoever might want to join, I suppose. I'm not sure if that answered your question, really. I was sort of spun off a bit.
I think that's great. I sort of understood that as that there's sort of an individual, I guess, kind of duty to make ourselves, you know, it's on us as individuals to, you know, work to break down the biases that we have. But it's also really important to have those channels available, say in university, to make a voice heard that wouldn't normally be. But that's what we, you know, we have to change. I have a final question for you, going back to what we were originally talking about leadership. What do you think are the best qualities of a leader?
I think a leader does need to keep very open lines of communication between themselves and the people that they are leading or the team that they're leading or whatever, so that they, I think a leader needs to be a really good listener first and foremost, and to enable, to create a culture where there is a culture of trust and people can come to that leader, or they can feed up in whatever ways it is. You know, if it's a large place like organizations, focus groups or questionnaires or whatever, But a leader needs to be able to listen to what is going on the ground, what people's concerns are. These are the people usually doing the work, living the life of the organisation. I'm not suggesting that the leader isn't. But then the leader is really well informed about what's going on. So the first and foremost, I would say, is to be a good listener. And then to be open to constructive criticism as part of that kind of listening process, and be able to have the authority and be able to implement change where change is needed then based on that. So I think there's often a sense of a leader kind of working in isolation, come on everybody, kind of I'll bring you with me. But in a way, the leader should be, so I suppose, sort of symbolically standing alongside the people that they're leading, because they're all part of that team. So I think, being able to work in that style, and it's what a lot of the leadership kind of literature tells us is that it's that sort of listening and communication is something that really works for enabling your organisation to perform well.
Thank you so much, Julie. That's some really great things to think about, and it's been really great to talk to you. Is there anything else that you just want to sort of, that's on your mind that, you'd want people to think about?
I guess just the sense of, thinking about your context at Durham University or at any university, as we were talking about people's individual responsibilities, I suppose it's about knowing what structures are there for you to have your voice heard, whether that's, something that you want to propose or something that you have witnessed and you perhaps wish to report, something problematic. And so it's knowing what's open to you, because I think often, people go around often not knowing what opportunities there are to say something. So I guess that's part of the responsibility as well, I guess, to just sort of suss out what the options are to be able to report something if you wish to, if you feel comfortable to do so.
Thank you so much, Julie, for coming on the podcast and talking to me.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode of The Hidden Agenda. For more information about Changing Relations and their amazing work, follow them on Instagram at Changing Relations, on Facebook and on the web at www.changingrelations.co.uk.